Oh, it's the New Books and Food Podcast.
Hi, this is Alan Salkin. I'm hosting New Books in Food. This week we're talking to Dr. Jamie Kaufman about her book, Acid Reflux Diet. It is hugely important topic, and Dr. Kaufman is a iconoclast in this field who is either way, way, way ahead of the game or is so controversial that nobody else believes what she's saying. And she's helped a lot of notable people. I'm going to just quickly read something from one of the introductions. The preface is by Dr. Max Gomez to this book, which is, he says, millions of Americans are taking medications they don't need and suffering from symptoms they shouldn't have. And so this book and Dr. Kaufman's unusual treatment for acid reflux and all of the other kinds of reflux that she defines are potentially life-saving for a lot of people. And this is not an infomercial. I'm just a journalist, like always. I've tried some of these methods, and we're going to talk about that during this interview. Dr. Kaufman, thank you for making the time to do this today. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
This is a pleasure, and I'm very, very looking forward to talking with you about this.
And I promise our listener she's going to sound better than she just sounded right there, because her voice is going to improve. I have to say also, I'm nervous that I'm going to cough and I'm going to like wheeze or something, and you're going to think that I'm, you know, you're going to diagnose me. And maybe that's a good thing. So let me just ask you the first thing that I want to know, which is, what's so damn bad about chocolate?
Well, chocolate is there. First of all, there are many different reasons why a person can have reflux. And some groups of foods, specific foods with specific chemicals in them, actually cause reflux by causing, hold on one second, by lowering the lower esophageal sphincter. So there's a valve called the lower esophageal sphincter that joins the stomach and the esophagus. And so reflux is backflow from the stomach. So one of the mechanisms of reflux is when that valve relaxes. And certain chemicals relax it. For example, caffeine and nicotine will relax it. In chocolate, there are several things. And so it's a key trigger food, not for everybody, but for many people. First of all, it has relatively high fat, at least milk chocolate. Fat is one of the things that makes the valve relax, which is why a big, heavy, high-fat meal is associated with reflux. So chocolate has fat in it. Secondly, it has caffeine in it. And third, it has theobromine. And theobromine, all three of these things work on the valve. So for many people, not everyone, but for many people, when I had bad reflux, my reflux could be under control for 2 weeks, and I would have one piece of chocolate, and it was like someone had put an ignition cap to a stick of dynamite, and I was off to the races. So chocolate for some people is a big trigger food. Not everyone, and probably dark chocolate's better than milk chocolate.
Yeah, it's funny because I literally don't know that I can write without chocolate. And so it's a big challenge for me because I've been, you know, trying some of your things. But let's bring people in a little bit more background, which is define, you know, what is acid reflux and what are the other – you also in this book come up with a term or introduce a term called respiratory reflux. What are the various things that we're talking about here?
Well, let me begin by saying that the medical model, the medical establishment's model of reflux is dead wrong, that we spend $100 billion a year to get it wrong. And so there is a backstory, and the backstory most people aren't aware of. The evolution of medical specialties is relatively recent. In the 70s, in the mid-70s, there were only 700 gastroenterologists. And these beautiful endoscopes came out. And today, there are 21,000 gastroenterologists. So we've had a 30-fold increase in gastroenterologists. In ENT, or otolaryngology, there's been a 14% increase over the course of the last 40 years. So what happened was, in my opinion, the gastroenterologist hijacked reflux. They took the most obvious symptoms, heartburn, indigestion, and they said, reflux is heartburn. Heartburn is reflux. It's esophageal, and we own it. As a consequence, we've spent $1.5 trillion, that's with a T, in the last 40 years. And during that time, on the GI watch, reflux has increased 400%. Esophageal cancer, which presumably they're looking for, has increased 800%. It's the fastest growing cancer in America in terms of its incidence. The whole question of safety, Joan Rivers, I'm not even going to talk about, is huge. So what's happened is the GI doctors have been the go-to doctors for reflux. So when a lung doctor, a pulmonologist, an ENT, an allergist says, I think this patient might have reflux, the patient has an endoscopy, gets put on a purple pill, and the presumption is that the GI doctor can determine whether a patient has reflux. It turns out I've been taking care of the most difficult reflux patients in the nation for almost 40 years now. People with respiratory problems, people with bad lungs, people with asthma that isn't asthma, people who have had multiple sinus surgeries. And as it turns out, at least in my population of patients, only 10% have heartburn as a chief complaint, which means the other 90% have other symptoms. And generally speaking, if you stick a scope in the esophagus and say they don't have reflux, it means nothing. And so as a consequence, the entire population is at risk for reflux. Respiratory reflux is bigger than heartburn. And so this has created a huge public health issue. And yeah, a lot of it's related to diet and lifestyle.
Right. And you talk about in the book and in other interviews that diet soda or soda, the addition of acidic preservatives and obviously just, you know, a higher fat diet and also sugar are some of the reasons that this is, you know, increased. And I also think, you know, I am a foodie and I thought something you wrote about, you know, there's a little piece in the book about a group of foodies going out to dinner at 8 and, you know, basically finishing around midnight. And, you know, you kind of say that within a few years, some of those people will be dead from this disease, or at least will be wheezing. And, you know, for my part, I'm on a CPAP machine, which really has made a difference, but we'll talk about that later maybe. And so it is incredibly, and it almost seems to me eating anything like a normal diet or even what a foodie would consider a good diet is going to land you with one of these diseases that you're talking about. I mean, everybody I know has it.
Well, let me back up for a minute and make a couple of other points that I think are iconoclastic. The first thing is that reflux doesn't come in one form in one stage. So most people who are in trouble with their symptoms, whether it's sinuses or sleep apnea, by the way, sleep apnea, big association with long-standing nighttime or nocturnal reflux. But reflux does have different stages. And one of the reasons why we do reflux testing at the Voice Institute is because we're interested in the question of what is working and what isn't working. So let me just sort of make up a story. The more your reflux, your lower valve gets inflamed and stops working. So the more your reflux, the more your reflux. Now your reflux enough so your esophageal function, the esophagus is the tube that connects the throat and the stomach, the esophageal function becomes impaired. Now when you lie down, essentially the esophagus looks like Lake Michigan, which I think is a good visual. And then the upper valve, which is really the main barrier to keep stuff out of the respiratory tract, and the respiratory tract, ear, nose, throat, vocal cords, you know, bronchial tubes, lungs, So then what happens is when you lie down at night, the esophagus is like Lake Michigan and the respiratory tract is like Lake Superior. And often people don't have symptoms unless they wake up in the middle of the night, you know, coughing or with breathing problems or even with heartburn. Many people sleep through it and then they wake up the next day and they have all these symptoms. And by the way, this whole process, as I've described it, is reversible. for most people for 90.
Why? You've been doing this a long time. You've had some, you know, great testimonials from celebrities even, which of course in America means everything. And but why aren't you being heard? And why, you know, I want to see, you know, I got scoped in my primary care doctor's office shortly after the Joan Rivers thing, you know, and I hate being, anesthetized. And, and then I talked to the doctor, and of course the very doctor who's doing the endoscopy is himself popping purple pills all the time. And I'm like, well,
the answer is it's all about money. We have a technology that I introduced in 1999 called transnasal esophagoscopy. It's done with an ultra thin in a comfortable patient. The scope is actually inside the patient, usually less than 5 minutes. I mean, there's prep and explaining and going through the reviewing the exam and all that. But the transnasal esophagoscopy technology is not without question should replace sedated esophagogastroduodenoscopy or EGD. There's no question. If you ask gastroenterologists why they don't do it, they don't do it because they don't make enough.
But can you see Barrett's esophagus with your method?
Of course. I would argue that my method is much more accurate. For every 3 patients who come to me with Barrett's esophagus, 2 of them don't have it. At the risk of being really controversial, the way the biopsies are done by many gastroenterologists is the problem. They use a large cup forceps. They're told to take multiple 4-quadrant biopsies. So after the first biopsy, there's blood everywhere in the field, and they go snip, 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 snip. And if they get a little low, then it's going to look like Barrett's. When we do transnasal esophagoscopy, the patient is awake, and you see the swallow, and the valve presents itself, and you can see exactly where the biopsy should be taken, and the precision of the technology we use, in my opinion, is much better. So we have a better technology, a safer technology, a more accurate technology, a well-tolerated technology, and it's a technology the patient doesn't even lose any time from work, right?
Are insurance companies covering it?
Absolutely. But guess what the gastroenterologist did? They went to CMS, which is who sets the Medicare rates. Mm-hmm. The gastroenterologists who don't do transnasal esophagoscopy went to CMS and had the reimbursement for transnasal esophagoscopy. They said, oh, let's review all these endoscopies, reduced. They had it reduced so they wouldn't have competition and so people wouldn't want to do it. The doctors are entrepreneurs in general. And so what's happening now is that there is pressure for transnasal esophagoscopy from patients everywhere. I get emails. Who's doing it in Portland, Oregon? Who's doing it in Austin, Texas? And the answer is most of the time, no one. And the reason why this technology has not exploded is because there's no one doctor willing to do it. The gastroenterologists don't want to do it. They own surgery centers. They make a lot of money on the facility fees. It's a huge conflict of interest. So the answer to the question you've raised is a massive one. I think, at least in my opinion, you want to hear a bottom line? We've done, I think, about 300 million sedated endoscopies, gastroenterologists, since 1975. If you look at the death rates, which is the smallest death rate reported in the literature, is 14 per 100,000. And there's some that say it's as high as 70 per 100,000. If that's the case, more people have lost their lives having sedated endoscopies than died in the Vietnam War. So, you know, the question, and they don't get reported as deaths from endoscopies. You know, they have a heart attack and they go in the hospital and, you know, something happens and they pass away and nobody says that. So the answer is that the technology, the structure, and the whole way that specialties police themselves. By the way, do you know the gastroenterologists do not video record their examinations? I've recorded every examination of mine since 1978. It's archived. It can be reviewed. And if you ask, again, if you ask gastroenterologists, why don't you record them? The answer is that they don't want scrutiny. They don't want
sure. Scrutiny. They want to get sued.
So the answer is you've got a massively powerful group of doctors who claim to be reflux doctors who don't do a very good job taking care of reflux.
What's the worst sort of – do you get attacked at conferences? Or
I don't, actually. You know, it's really sort of amazing. I'll tell you what happens is I get marginalized. Here's an example. I know all the opinion leaders in gastroenterology. It's a long story, and it's a good story, but it's a long one. But I know the opinion leaders. So one of the opinion leaders in gastroenterology put a course on at the Marriott Marquis about, I don't know, I think it was in December. Okay? So I contacted him, and I said, you know, do you want me to talk about respiratory reflux? And the answer is we've already invited somebody. Who did they invite? They invited somebody who knows nothing about it. They literally invited an otolaryngologist who is going to do a literature review. That, to me, is a specialty that's circling the wagons.
You know, and there's another aspect here which you talk about. It's on page 5 of your book, which is that, you know, the old belief that you can't trust the patient just wants a pill, you know, the same reason that everyone's popping for years antibiotics. You write in the book, the belief shared by doctors and patients appears to be that patients are noncompliant and unwilling to change. Just give me a pill, demands the patient, or better yet, a surgical procedure to end my reflux. But patients need help understanding that unhealthy lifestyles cause disease and the change is possible. So what you're suggesting in the book is not, you know, it may take as fast as 2 weeks, but it's not as, and I'll tell you, it is, you have to really get your head behind, okay, I'm going to eat something different for 2 weeks. And it involves.
It's bigger than that. Listen, here's what's happened. In our lifetimes, the food industry has made us sick. Okay. It wasn't like this. Okay, everyone didn't eat at 8:30, and people didn't drink, you know, the equivalent of, you know, 16 6-ounce cans or whatever, 8-ounce mm-hmm. cans of soda a day. We didn't eat like this. The food industry is very much responsible for, I mean, the diabetes and obesity and sleep apnea and asthma and reflux epidemics are all the same epidemic. Mm-hmm. You know, add sugar, add fat, add late night eating, add all these variables. Throw in, it's not called dropping acid for nothing, that first book. But when you add all of these things, in my lifetime, the healthcare industry has made us poor. And they're essentially in collusion with, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently saying that it was much, much more efficient to do bariatric surgery for obesity than try to get patients to change their ways. Mm. My experience, and so let me just pause and take a breath. If it weren't for the fact that my patients not only stop refluxing, but graduate, I look them in the eye and I say, my goal for you is not to need me a year from now, not to need medicine, and for you to live a long, healthy life. Longevity is the long-term goal. And the kind of changes that you make are a bit like opening Pandora's box. You always have to think about food, what you eat and when you eat it. And that, unfortunately, is a paradigm shift.
Yeah, and let me take that as a jumping off point for a second to take a left turn, which is to talk about you for a second and how you are a great iconoclast, and you seem, you know, very bold and courageous and willing to take on this industry. And you know, you're making a good living at it, and you've put out successful books. But how did you get in this game, and how did you figure out this other way of doing it?
First of all, thank you for asking that question. I'll tell you the story. It's wonderful. I was going to be a general surgeon because I had two uncles who were general surgeons. And when I went to Boston University because my uncle went there. And I heard this guy was doing laser surgery. Dr. Strong was doing laser surgery. And I went and I saw a young man had come from New York with the growths on his vocal cords. He was singing in the Hair. It was that era, Hair. It was in the 70s. And this was done there, can you imagine a massive, we didn't see 50-inch screens, but on a big screen TV, the vocal cords looking two feet long with every little vessel you could see. And the surgery was done with precision, with no cutting in the neck. The patient woke up and basically could be discharged. So we were doing outpatient vocal cord surgery in patients who had throat problems that had never been done before. There were only two lasers in the country. When I finished my residency in 1978, I had the fourth CO2 laser in the United States. I went to Wake Forest University, and they said, we'll give you whatever you need. I put together an anesthesia team to manage the difficult airways. We did children with respiratory papillomas. That's a terrible disease. We did people with cancers. We did all kinds of work. And I very aggressively went after the difficult patient. And so what happened, by 1981, I had a national practice, and I was seeing all the people that had complications. And I began to see people who had complications, who had things in common. They had inflammation and swelling in their voice box. And so at that point, it was 1986 or 85, I said, let's put a pH probe in the throat, an acid measuring device. The gastroenterologist said, there's nothing in the throat. I said, there's something in the throat. So he put the pH probes in the throat, and sure enough, all the patients that had inflammation, that were having complications, that were doing poorly, had reflux. And so we started doing double probe pH monitoring. Today, now, how many years later is this, 30-something years, almost nobody is using this technology. And so we're still looking. If you go buy yourself a expensive pH meter, that's the chip we're using. We're using an ISFET chip to measure acidity. So what happened is I began to look at this patient population systematically. And it wasn't enough just to look at the patients. And we reported all these things. We reported respiratory problems in children and how many of them had reflux. And we documented it. We looked at these things in the laboratory. And then finally, I had a basic science laboratory, so we looked at the impact of acid and pepsin on the larynx as well as the esophagus. And what we found and what we are finding is that the basic enzyme pepsin, which is the main stomach enzyme, is what causes damage in tissue everywhere. It's not acid. So it really is peptic esophagitis, peptic laryngitis. The key is pepsin requires acid activation. So to make a long story short, I've looked at the epidemiology. I've looked at the outcomes. I've looked at the diagnostic technology. And I've looked at the cell biology. And I feel that this paradigm is going to require a restructuring of medical specialties and a restructuring of healthcare. And the whole purpose really should be, and when you say this, everyone wants to go, duh, should be health maintenance and disease prevention. And there are ways to do this that make sense to people. Before I finish this sort of refrain, I want to say to you, if it weren't for the fact that most of my patients get well, then I would be a crazy person. But the fact that I have patients who get well, I'm going to tell one story, and it's a great story.
Keep going. I love it. You sound great.
A young man came to see me with a tracheotomy in, 20-something, young. He was one of the top athletes in the state of North Carolina. He was going to be a kicker for the University of North Carolina. He could kick the ball 60 yards. Meanwhile, by the time they were getting ready to start training and he graduated from school, in that 3 months, he ended up with a tracheotomy in his throat. And he had a disease called relapsing polychondritis, which is an autoimmune disease in which your body attacks your cartilages. The nose is often involved, the ears involved, and the worst, the larynx and the airway. So this kid has a tracheotomy in place. And he comes to see me. He's being taken care of at Duke and at Mayo Clinic. Okay? So he's got the best.
Right.
And I look at him and I say, Ward, this disease is a slow, indolent disease. It's not a progressive disease. You must have reflux to accelerate this. The combination It's like fighting fire with water in one hose and gasoline in the other. So I tested him for reflux using this new technology, and he had terrible reflux. I said, you need to go have surgery for reflux. There are very few people who need surgery, but you need surgery. At the time, they had to open the belly up, and they wrapped the stomach around the esophagus, and they can stop it. And in truth, both Mayo Clinic and Duke told him not to do it. He had the surgery, stopped his reflux, and after he's had a tracheotomy in for 2 years, 3 months later, I took it out. This man, it's now 20 years later. They were going to do a stem cell. They had told him he was going to die. They did not recognize reflux as the major confounding variable in this patient's care. This man is extremely successful. He's recently got married. He runs a program. So the idea... That reflux is, and by the way, I was getting gas today, and the car in front of me, there was this man with oxygen on his nose, carrying his little thing as he was, and I listened to him. Only reflux can produce this profound kind of change in a rapid fashion. So, last thing about this, in New York right now, on New York One. They have an ad that shows, I think, someone coughing in the middle of the night, and it's a young person. It says, you know, if you've got COPD, if you're not smoking and you've got COPD, it's reflux. So what I'm saying to you is I've taken care of these patients now from everywhere for a long period of time, and the outcomes, particularly a case like Ward's, are so dramatic that it is the exception that proves the rule.
To get treated by you yourself, it costs what, like $5,000?
It depends, okay? Just so you should know, I'm not proud of being in private practice. I'm semi-retired. I can't retire. I'll never retire. People like when you drop dead, you're retired.
Yeah.
But in other words, I would become a full-time writer, with the idea being that, you know, these changes will not occur likely in my lifetime. The ones that I think are important, integrated aerodigestive medicine is the name of the field. Integrated aero, meaning the airway and the respiratory tract, digestive medicine. It's one system. I practice integrated aerodigestive medicine. So these ideas are ideas that are difficult. So if you ask me what do I do, the answer is I am expensive and people do come to see me from all over. On the other hand, being in private practice, I do have the ability to charge what I want, meaning none. So a young woman came to see me last week. She desperately needs me. She could barely handle the bus fare to come to see me, and from upstate New York. And I told her, we'll take whatever you can afford to pay us. One of the groups of patients that I never send a bill to, the first responders and the people who worked at Grounds.
Yeah. Well,
so the answer is yes, I'm expensive, but
well,
I mean,
but I'm not specifically even, you know, whatever, accusing you of overcharging or being expensive. What I'm saying is that the kind of sort of holistic care that you're talking about, that everybody who really thinks about healthcare who's not in it wants, where you go to a doctor and he thinks, you know the problem. I do.
It's you know what's so funny about it? I'm writing a book, by the way, just so you should know, right now, called "Fix Healthcare and Heal the Nation," which is another conversation. And it if you think what I've written is aggressive now, wait till you read it. But I think that there is going to have to be a moment. If you think about it, when I was little, one of my earliest childhood memories is having otitis media, an earache, and the pain was so intense that I was pinned on the floor under the dining room table, unable to move, clutching my ear, and sobbing. And I remember the doctor coming at 5 o'clock, about 5 o'clock on a Saturday night, and he looked at me and he just pulled down my pants and gave me a shot of penicillin. Okay, now that doctor was a GP. He made a house call. My family didn't believe in insurance at that time. We're talking 1950. Blue Cross Blue Shield was available, and I'm betting we paid that doctor, you know, $15 or $20 for that visit. So what happened, that was a whole different era of doctors. And then came a whole bunch of doctors who were entrepreneurs. They ran business plans. People don't do reflux testing like I do. It doesn't reimburse enough. But endoscopy traditionally has reimbursed a lot, and now it's going down. The Medicare is going to have an influence. But the reality is that once it was clear that there was a lot of money to be made in medicine, it became corporate. And now more doctors work for companies than work
in the Is something that you've spent effort on training disciples? Do you wish you'd done more of that?
The answer is that my stuff is so controversial in the field of otolaryngology because people just don't – I would argue otolaryngologists, ear, nose, and throat doctors don't know what reflux is because they don't know what normal looks like. It's so ubiquitous. They don't know what normal looks like. But if they go to a gastroenterologist and the gastroenterologist says, really, I don't see anything, then the patient is stuck. So what I have done, I resigned from the American Academy of Otolaryngology, and here's why I did it. I had given the course on reflux for, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. The course was a big course. I mean, it was a big room with a lot of people. They made a lot of money on the course. But in the reviews, one year I said, y'all need to be doing transnasal esophagoscopy. And here's why. One of these days, you're going to get a lawsuit for malpractice, and a patient who has sinus disease and postnasal drip is going to get esophageal cancer. And you're going to be sued because you never examined their esophagus. And you need to start doing it. And there was quiet in the room. You could hear a pin drop. And so I got some bad reviews. And the people who were organizing the courses, a couple of not friends of mine, said, well, maybe we can get someone else to give the reflux course. So the answer is, in the field of otolaryngology, which is basically my parent field, I would argue that the specialty really knows virtually nothing about reflux disease.
No, you know, I agree with you.
On a scale of one to ten, it's something between a 2 and a 3.
Yeah, I mean, I've had for years, you know, it's like a family disease, and we think we have sinus infections, and we're always clearing our throats, and it's snoring, and it's everything else, and I have hit that wall quite a few times, and that's why I was so interested by your book. Talking about just going back to that, you being a little girl under the table, what did your parents do?
About what? My ear infection?
No. What was your dad's job?
I had a very interesting life. My father was a lawyer, and he ran a firm in Boston. He started out with a couple of college people, and they went to and he actually, his partner was governor of Massachusetts in the Kennedy McCormick heyday. And so I had a very, very interesting life. I met a lot of the people like the Kennedys and so on in my days. So he was relatively wealthy. My grandfather was a Russian immigrant who became a builder and became very successful. And in my family, the key for everything was education. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that was the I wanted to work for my grandfather one summer. And the response was, no, you go to Harvard Summer School. I'll pay for it.
And what about, you know, in your era, how many women were in your medical class?
Oh, actually, Boston University was really started as a women's medical college. Ah. Yeah. Yeah, it's complicated, Boston University. But no, I think it's very interesting. I was a visiting professor in Nottingham, in England. And as I was being taken back to my hotel, I got walked through the medical school. And there on the wall was the graduate picture of the graduating class starting, I don't know, 50 or 60 years before. And you'd see, you know, 6 or 8 men in their cricket outfits. and that was the medical school class. And then you kept walking, and the classes got bigger, and they were all men, and they were all men, and they were all men. And only in the last 25 years, and now you go walk to the end of the hall, and the class is all women. Yes. So I said to my host, what happened? He said, well, now admissions is based only on scholastic aptitude, meaning it used to be sort of a men's specialty and women weren't allowed in. And now that it's based upon academic performance, the women seem to be topping the men, in, at least in England.
That's like the song. That's right. The women are smarter. This is Dr. Jamie Kaufman. I'm talking to her latest book is Acid Reflux Diet. It's got 111 all new recipes, including vegan and gluten free. But it's funny because it's like a hybrid. You know, 2/3 of the book is a cookbook, but the first third is this really, just like you, a kind of iconoclastic and yet informational examination of what's really going on with our diet and how to self-diagnose. A litany of problems that are related to what we eat.
Let me make a quick summary of the symptoms. One of the characteristics of respiratory reflux is that people have lots of symptoms. So if you just have one symptom, for example, if you just have hoarseness, maybe a problem with a vocal cord, but people who have respiratory reflux will have hoarseness, often worse in the morning. Postnasal drip, chronic throat clearing, sticky throat, a sensation of a lump in the throat, cough, and of course all the other things I've mentioned, things that look like asthma and sinusitis and an allergy, because those symptoms get confused. But, you know, people who have this will know, gee, the night they went out, they overate, they didn't have any lunch hardly, and they just, they packed in another dessert because it was sitting there on the table, and then they all sat around and said, let's get another bottle of wine, and he wakes up the next morning, and he knows that something is different and worse, and it does have to do with the diet and lifestyle. The meal.
You know, years ago, Mark Bittman wrote a piece, and you've written for the New York Times, and I, the piece that I noticed that you wrote, I don't know if this is your most recent one, was about stop not eating past 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock at night, closing the kitchen 4 hours before bed.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. It's called The Dangers of Late Night Eating. Mm-hmm. The Dangers of Late Night Eating was an op-ed for the Times in October of last year, October 2014.
Yeah.
That piece was among the top 10 most emailed New York Times articles for 6 weeks. It's unbelievable. And I got letters from editors saying this is sort of unprecedented. A friend of mine said I was sitting in Australia in the airport in Melbourne, and I heard people talking about this article.
Yeah.
So, you know, this. Let's just talk for a moment about late night eating or eating late, and what's the opposite, and what constitutes healthy. Many Americans don't have much breakfast. It's on the fly. They usually have a sandwich that they wolf down at lunch. And they don't really have much in the way of snacks. Maybe after work they go, you know, to exercise at the gym. Maybe they have childcare responsibilities. So maybe they're thinking about their own food. This is a daily basis. This isn't like a big night out. And all of a sudden it's 8:30 and they're in the kitchen starved.
Right.
That problem is really and by the way, if you take the same person and it's a young person and they drink a lot of acid, they get up in the morning and they have orange juice, then they go to the workout and they have, you know, Gatorade, and then they have lunch and they have a Coke, and then they're thirsty and they get a Snapple, and so all day, everything in a bottle or can is acidic. So they reflux during the night. There's the pepsin, this enzyme, lying around waiting to be activated by more acid. Which is why dropping acid, right? You want to lower the acid intake.
Dropping Acid was the name of your first book.
So. Yeah, Dropping Acid is really, you know, if you really want to think about these two books, I meant for them to be intended to be companion books. Dropping Acid is really the first book, which is the sort of the whole story about reflux for the start. What do you do first? And the second book talks about longevity. If this was a weight loss program, Dropping Acid would be how do you lose the weight? And Dr. Kaufman's acid reflux diet would be how do you keep it off. Now, I will tell you, I believe that what I've proposed in this book is crucial longevity diet information. Lean, clean, green, and alkaline. The other thing is I strongly recommend people have breakfast and a snack and lunch and a snack and get 3/4 of their calories for the day in before 5.
So they don't end up in the situation you were talking about where they're in the kitchen starving at 8:30 and they Ralph down an entire pizza.
It just takes some planning. For example, when I go to work at the beginning of the week, I lug avocados, bananas, chicken breasts with nice flavorings that have been diced up in little Ziplocs. I have some salmon that's left over, some rice, and fruit, other fruits. I consider the three healthiest fats to be avocado, olive oil, and fish, particularly salmon. So that those are, if you will, heavy, you know, heavy part of my diet. There's not much of a day that does. And by the way, I've substituted olive oil for butter completely. I have a baked potato. I scrape it out. I put liberal amounts of olive oil on it and a little bit of salt, and that's potato.
You're making me hungry.
It's a good snack, a baked potato. I make an extra one, too, usually. Just leave it in the refrigerator.
Well, let me just So Bittman wrote a piece, Mark Bittman, obviously the great food writer, and about that he had cut out all milk products, and that had solved at least his acid reflux problem. I don't know, you know, I know Bittman, but I haven't asked him about this in years. What is with milk and acid reflux, or what do you think about his piece?
Okay, the answer is that everybody's different. So let me have a conversation. Let me tell you another story.
Well, let me just throw one other thing in there before you tell the story, which is, you know, everybody's different, and you know, you talk about being, you know, you have family in Russia, and so I'm assuming you're, you know, Jewish, Eastern European descent. Bittman probably is also. I am also. I mean, and not that there's some conspiracy going on here, but
reflux runs in families. We don't know exactly what the link, whether it has to do with lousy valves or more acid or who knows.
Or genetics of some kind.
It runs in families, okay. No question about it.
Okay.
No question.
So go ahead. Milk and you were saying.
Well, I wanted to tell you a story.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those stories that sort of is intriguing, and it's a two-part story because the first is a failure and the second is a success. So a young woman came to see me. It was 28 years old, and she was she weighed about 300 pounds, but she was tall. She was 5'4". That's a joke. So she was a hugely obese young woman, and she'd already had bariatric surgery. So she'd had surgery.
I'm laughing inside.
She was obese again. And actually, she had reflux. She'd had reflux surgery, and she was refluxing again. And she came to see me because she was asking me what surgery, what I could do to stop her reflux. This was the one who was not compliant. For her, going out in the evening and, you know, shoveling in as much ice cream and other high-fat, high-sugar food she could was all there was in her life. I said to her, okay, what do I do with somebody who has obesity? This is really not something that most people will consider, but many do. So if someone's got bad reflux and obesity, we have to basically treat the reflux specifically. But let's leave that aside and talk about the diet. You read Wheat Belly, and you know that the glycemic index of bread, and Americans have bread, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, cookies, cakes, everything else. The glycemic index of sugar, if you eat it out of the bowl, is 59, and the glycemic index of bread is 72. What this means is if you take in excess sugar, you make fat. So there's a lot of bread. So you're going to say, okay, I want to make you gluten-free. By the way, that's why a third of the nation is gluten-free. They're not all gluten-sensitive, but they're trying to get rid of the bread. So, and that's another story. We changed. This is all in
the wheat belt.
So anyway, so I say, okay, I want you to go gluten-free. Now, if you go gluten-free, first thing you find out is, boy, those gluten-free chocolate chip cookies are great. And guess what they put in them? A ton of sugar, real sugar. So you're moving from one type of sugar to another type of sugar. So if you're going to go gluten-free, then you got to go sugar-free too, at least no sugar added. And if you're going to go, then you got to go dairy-free, because what do you leave? You leave cheese and ice cream and all the high-fat foods. So what I do with someone who's got terrible reflux and obesity is I say, how would you like to change your life? I want to put you on a gluten-free, sugar-free, dairy-free diet for a year. What does it leave? Lean, clean, green, and alkaline. It means they have to plan their meals. We do meal plans where they sit down and they say, okay, I'm a big fan of the banana right now and the avocado, so I'm going to always have, you know, figure out so that they're getting ripe, you know, across the week, so I have a reasonable fruit. They start to do a little bit of cooking. A good example, I think, is the egg. When you restrict dairy, we don't restrict eggs. Eggs are fantastic. Every meal is not a delight. So what I do when I'm traveling, when I take the plane back on Monday, I'll have boiled eggs. And what I do is, and by the way, buy jumbo eggs because the yolks are the same in all the eggs, so you're getting more white. What I do is I have an extra little baggie, and as I'm eating my egg, I drop out about two-thirds of the yolk. So I like the flavor of the yolk, but I can eat three eggs with a little bit of salt, and I'm essentially having three eggs with one yolk because it's cholesterol and fat, high protein, kick. And that's a good example of the kind of on-the-go snack that is successful for people. And so,
go ahead.
And so what you say is you got someone who's obese, who's got diabetes, who's got high cholesterol, who's got bad reflux, and you ask them, can you do this or do you want to try to do this? And a lot of them can and some of them can't.
One thing I've noticed in your work, it seems like you've kind of become more interested in alkaline water or alkaline water.
Yeah, alkaline water is special. If you look at the pH scale for listeners is sort of bizarre. It runs essentially from 0 to 14, and neutral or not acidic is 7, right in the middle. So below 7 is acidic. And above 7 is alkaline. So if you take alkaline and acid, the alkaline will neutralize the acid. Now, almost everything in a bottle or a can is pH 2, which is the same as stomach acid, pH 2, pH 3. And by the way, the pH scale is logarithmic, like the Richter scale, which means
right.
2 is 10 times more acidic than 3 and 100 times more acidic than 4. So the only thing that occurs in all of nature that comes easily, that has no side effects, that's not a medicine, is alkaline water. And so water trickles through the ground under caverns, who knows what, for thousands of years and comes up in wherever it comes up. Say they dig a hole in a place called Louisiana, and the water has calcium carbonate, and it's become alkaline. So we know some things about this enzyme pepsin, and the enzyme pepsin dies at pH 8. We've done this work in the laboratory, and we looked at alkaline water, and alkaline water kills pepsin. Alkaline water helps wash out pepsin. Alkaline water helps neutralize acid. So alkaline water is healthy and particularly useful for the reflux.
So why not just not do anything else you're saying and drink a glass of alkaline water every 20 minutes?
Well, I don't know if that would work or not. And the question is how alkaline and what expense. By the way, I don't buy it anymore. I have a special filter that I one of those. It looks like a Brita, but it's not. It's called Sierra Water, and it's a Canadian woman. And it makes alkaline water, and one little those filters last months. Hmm. And so I just refill that. But
How do you spell it?
It's C-E-R-R-A water, all one word, .com. And she's lovely, and it's really a nice. And by the way, the little filter I got in mine, I do pH test it with the pH paper. I put in September, and it's still making alkaline water. I've washed the whole thing out 4 times, but it still works. And other filters, if you buy filters, you know, in the store, regular, where they actually make the water slightly more acidic. So this is quite specific. And I just leave it on my desk, and that's what I drink all the time. When I travel, the bottles, the waters that are most available everywhere that are more alkaline are Fiji water and Deer Park. The Icelandic waters are terrific. Evermore water is terrific. And nowadays, there are waters that are being manufactured. Coca-Cola has one called Essentia. They take tap water and they manipulate it. I don't recommend them quite as highly, but they're cheaper. And the reason is there are phosphates and there are other chemicals in them, and they bother some of my patients.
Let me ask you one quick thing and then get into one other area before we have to go, because yoga. Turning yourself upside down, twisting yourself, is this a problem? It's something that's occurred to me. Sometimes I get some symptoms right after yoga, which obviously is great in so many other ways.
The answer is your valve's not so good. You're going to come see me and I'll take care of you. That valve is fixable. I recommend taking a product called Gaviscon Advance Aniseed. Gaviscon is available, not in this country. It's a political thing. The brand of Gaviscon that's available in our pharmacies is not, in my opinion, comparable. So you got to get it online, and it's easy to get online. But Gaviscon is not an antacid, and what it does is it gums up the valve in a good way. And so I recommend that refluxers not eat before they go work out, or eat light, have a banana, and then take Gaviscon Advance before you work out, particularly with yoga.
Yeah, well, yoga you can't really eat 2 hours before. It's one of the good things.
Yeah, but let me make a comment to you. I think you know the story gets a lot bigger if you come see me.
Okay. I'm going to take you up on that. All right, let me get into, just before I lose you, one other thing, which is your writing, you know, because I'm interested in writing and you know, it's what I do. I don't know if you – I think you're a friend of – a mutual friend, Sue Shapiro, and maybe she helped you.
Absolutely.
How did you start to, you know, decide to put your books together, and what do you think about as a writer?
Well, first of all, Sue is wonderful. Yeah. I had great fun. The story is actually quite different. I had a friend who was depressed, and I said, you need a project, you know, something that meets on a regular basis, that just breaks up your week. So we decided we'd take a writing class together. So that's how I met her. And she's great. And my
– Was it out of Sue's class that you developed your
– No, I have a fat curriculum vitae. I've published thousands of pages and multiple books going back to the 70s. So I consider – but I've always been a writer. I think she made me a better writer.
Okay.
But what I was starting to say is I have ADD, and I figured out a really, really good strategy for me, which is that I write by the clock. So I have to sit still with an egg timer for 40 minutes, not get out of that chair. And then I take 20 minutes off, and then I sit another 40 minutes on my writing days. And so I'm always writing a book, and I think that the next book is going to hopefully catalyze a national dialogue about our healthcare system, and I think it's time.
I agree. But talking to Dr. Jamie Kaufman, the book is Acid Reflux Diet, and I strongly recommend it. And maybe we'll do a follow-up interview after I go get scoped. I'm in California right now, but when I'm back in a couple months in New York, we will figure out something. So it's such an honor, and I'm so glad we did have this time to talk. Thank you very much, and thank you to your publicist, Carrie, for helping to set this up.
Thank you.
No problem.
This is New Books in Food, part of the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com, where there are interviews with authors on every subject you can imagine. It's a great site. Check it out to find recipes and other material related to what we talked about today. Check out cookbooks.about.com, the about.com website for which I am the cookbooks and food writing expert. My website is allensalkin.com, A-L-L-E-N, S like Sam, A-L-K-I-N. All my social media is Alan Salkin. Also, Instagram, Facebook is facebook.com/Salkin. Twitter is Alan Salkin. I think you can find me. Guess what? My name's Alan Salkin. Thanks for listening.